suitable, the success rate of resumes is clearly no more than 7%. And I'm being generous with that estimate. One study suggested that only 1 out of 1,470 resumes actually resulted in a job. Another study found the figure to be even worse. One job offer for every 1,700 resumes floating around out there. By the way, once you post your resume on the internet, it gets copied quickly by spiders from other sites, and you can never remove it completely from the internet. There are reportedly now at least 40 million resumes floating around out there in the ether, like lost ships on the Sargasso Sea. Yours among them. That can come back to haunt you if you ever fibbed, lied about anything, once a would-be employer Googles you, even years later. 3. Answering local newspaper ads. This method works somewhere between 5% of the time on up to 24% at best. The statistics I allude to throughout this chapter fluctuate somewhat from year to year, from geographical region to region, from one field to another, from one city, town, or rural area to another. Their best value is how they compare to other job hunting methods. That ratio tends to remain fairly constant and predictable year after year. One exception? The success rate for resumes got worse after 2008. In fact, much worse. And despite the recovery we are experiencing, the success rate hasn't improved as much as you would have expected. With this method, you answer help wanted ads in your local newspaper, especially the Sunday edition, assuming your city or town still has a newspaper, online or in print or both. See www.jobhunt.org/findingjobs/findingjobs_classifieds.shtml for how to use them. As for a directory of online newspapers from around the U.S., your best bet is www.usnpl.com. The fluctuation between 5% and 24% is due to the level of salary that is being sought. Those job hunters looking for low-level salary jobs find this method works 24% of the time. Those looking for a high salary find it works only 5% of the time. 4. Going to private employment agencies or search firms for help. This method apparently works somewhere between 5% of the time on up to 28% at best. These agencies used to place just office workers. Now it's hard to think of a category of jobs they don't try to place, especially in large metropolitan areas. A directory of these firms in your area can be found at www.yellowpages.com. Into their search engine, put employment agencies and the name of your local town or city to get the relevant listings. The wide variation in success rate, 5% to 28%, is due to the fact that these agencies vary greatly in their staffing, ranging from extremely competent on down to inept or running a scam. But at their best, agencies are 4 times more effective than just depending on your resume. 5. Answering ads in professional or trade journals, appropriate to your field. This method apparently works only 7% of the time. The method consists of looking at professional journals in your profession or field and answering any ads there that intrigue you. A directory of these associations and their journals can be found at www.directoryofassociations.com. 6. Job clubs. There are hundreds of job hunting groups that call themselves job clubs. Sorry, they are not. Their job hunting success rate is usually around 10%, if that. They tend to meet only once a week, and then for only a couple of hours, and may more accurately be described as job search support groups. A true job club is something quite different. They have, or had, a success rate of 84%. The term was invented by Nathan Azrin. In his method, job hunting was a 9-to-5 job, Monday through Friday, every week. You met with other job hunters during the hours 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. each day to work on the inventory of yourself, to research companies that interested you, and to contact them by phone. During the morning sessions, you worked with a partner, and each of you took turns listening to the other on the phone, using an extension phone, and then the partner gave you feedback after you had hung up. From 1 to 5 p.m., you then went out individually into the community, town, or city, and actually visited places, doing informational interviews, or keeping appointments you had set up. Before you went out, each job hunter shared with the rest of the group what kind of job they were looking for. That meant you had other eyes out there looking for any leads, rhymes with needs, that might help you. And you, of course, did the same for them. This method worked well over 84% of the time. Many years ago, I audited groups that used this method, plus similar job clubs in Michigan, Boston, San Diego, and Northern California, and I can tell you those job clubs worked as well as I have here described. But the model is rarely to be found anymore for four reasons. The loss of federal funding, CETA, for such programs, the increasing use of the telephone as a barrier instead of for communication. Please choose among the following eight options. The rise of new technologies, the internet, email, texting, etc. And, I hate to say it, but I'm afraid it's true, a diminishing willingness in Western culture to have to work this hard at the job hunt. So most so-called job clubs meet only once a week, and then for only 1, 2, or 3 hours at best. The success rate has dropped to only 10% on average. There are exceptions. But the blueprint still exists and could be updated if our culture ever decides to revive, and could find the funding for, such a successful approach. But here's some good news, for now. Even dumbed-down job search support groups have one sterling virtue, and that is they provide a community for the otherwise lonely job hunter. This is a great gift. No one should ever have to job hunt all by themselves if they can possibly avoid it. We all need encouragement and support along the way. And done well, as in the Rotary Club's job search support group in Cupertino, California, they can enjoy a higher success rate than merely 10%. Cupertino's is 50% year after year using this book as their guide. 7. Going to the state or federal employment office. This method works 14% of the time. You go to your local federal or state unemployment service office, www.dol.gov/dol/location.htm, or to their nationwide career one-stop business centers, www.careerone-stop.org, to get instructions on how to better job hunt and find job leads. 8. Going to places where employers pick up workers. If you're a union member, particularly in the trades or construction, and you have access to a union hiring hall, this method will find you work up to 22% of the time. What is not stated, however, is how long it may take to get a job at the hall and how short-lived such a job may be. In the trades, it's often just a few days. Moreover, this is not a job hunting method that is open to a very large percentage of job hunters at all. Only 6.4% of private sector employees are union members these days. For employees in the public sector, the comparable figure is 34.4%. If you're not a union member, there's something similar to union halls. That is, employers may pick up workers, called day laborers, early in the morning on well-known street corners in your town or city. Ask around. It's called pickup work. It's usually short-term, usually yard work, or work that requires you to use your hands, usually paid to you in cash that day, and definitely temp work. But if you're not finding full-time work as yet, this may be a stopgap approach that at least can bring in a little money. The modern-day version of pickup work is the so-called sharing economy or access economy. You can explore using your home, www.airbnb.com, or your 2005-plus four-door car, either www.uber.com or www.lyft.com, or other things, even your driveway, www.justpark.com, to make some extra money. There are numerous articles about this sharing economy. See a U.S. article, time.com/36873/testing-the-sharing-economy. And a British one, http://www.spectator.co.uk/2015/03/get-your-share-of-sharing-economy if you want to explore this kind of pickup work. 9. Asking for job leads. This method works 33% of the time. With this method, you ask family members, friends, and people you know in the community, or on LinkedIn, if they know of any place where someone with your talents and background is being sought. It is a simple question. Do you know of any job vacancies at the place where you work or elsewhere? Using this method, you have an almost 5 times better chance of finding a job than if you had just sent out your resume. 10. Knocking on the door of any employer, office, or manufacturing plant. This method works 47% of the time. It works best with small employers, 25 or less employees, as you might have guessed. Sometimes you blunder into a place where a vacancy has just developed. One job hunter knocked on the door of an architectural office at 11 a.m. His predecessor, for he did get hired there, had just quit at 10 a.m. that morning. If you try this method and nothing turns up, you broaden your definition of small employer to those with 50 or less employees. With this method, you have an almost 7 times better chance of finding a job than if you had just depended on your resume. 11. Using the Yellow Pages. This method works 65% of the time. It involves going through the Yellow Pages of your local phone book, or actually the index to those Yellow Pages, so you can identify subjects or fields of interest to you. Then you go from the index to the actual Yellow Pages and look up names of organizations or companies in those fields in that town or city where you want to work. You call them, set up an appointment, go visit them, and explore whether or not they are hiring for the kind of work you do or the position you are looking for. Of course, in this post-2008 period, it's a lot harder to get employers to consent to see you. In large companies, anyway. Still, you will note that you have a 9 times better chance of finding a job with this method than if you had just depended on your resume. Well, that's it. That's the traditional approach split up into its 11 parts. These job hunting methods were not created equal. Some methods, as we have seen, had a pretty good track record, and therefore will repay you for time spent pursuing them. But other methods have a really terrible track record and are a waste of your time and energy. It's all about conservation of energy. And wisdom would say conserve your energy, invest it well. So we turn now, in the next chapters, to the other approach to job hunting or career changing, the parachute approach. It begins not with examining the job market, but with examining yourself. A final note. Job hunting is, or should be, a full-time job. If your job hunt isn't working, you must increase the amount of time you're devoting to your job hunt. If you want to devote as little time to your job hunt as possible, then fine, try it. But if that doesn't lead to a job, then you are going to have to devote more time to it. By the way, there is an app for your iPhone or Android that helps you stay on track by nudging you about your job hunting activities each day. Its author is Marshall J. Karp, and it's free. www.jobsearchpowermeter.com. Its display may show only one column, but there are actually three columns. Swipe left or right to see the other two. The left column is the one you most want. Your object, to get into the green part of the meter each day by doing the activities it suggests. Nice app. You do get to a certain point in life where you have to realistically, I think, understand that the days are getting shorter. And you can't put things off thinking you'll get to them someday. If you really want to do them, you better do them. So I'm very much a believer in knowing what it is that you love doing so that you can do a great deal of it. Nora Ephron, 1941 to 2012. Chapter 4, Self-Inventory, Part 1. Introduction. Make no mistake, this isn't just a matter of staring at your navel. This is a job hunting method, the most effective one at that. This method, faithfully followed step by step, works 86% of the time. That means that out of every 100 job hunters or career changers who faithfully execute this job hunting method, 86 will get lucky and find a job thereby. 14 job hunters out of the 100 will not, if they use only this method. Note well, you have 12 times better chance of finding work using this method than if you had just sent out your resume. Not just work, but work you really want to do. What we sometimes refer to as our dream job. Why a self-inventory? Why does an inventory of who you are work so well in helping you find work after traditional job hunting methods have failed? That's important to know because the answer will keep you motivated to finish this inventory when otherwise you might say, OMG, this is just too much work, and just give up. Okay, here are 7 answers as to why this works so well. 1. By doing this homework on yourself, you learn to describe yourself in at least 6 different ways. And therefore you can approach multiple job markets. Retraining, as it is commonly practiced in Western culture, prepares you for only one market. Thus, someone decides that out-of-work construction workers should be retrained, let us say, to be computer repair people. Hence, their job hunt approaches only one market. And if no jobs can be found in that market once they are trained, retraining wasted. This is why retraining programs sometimes acquire such a bad reputation. But with an inventory of who you are, you stop identifying yourself by only one job title. You can now think of yourself as not just a computer repair person, or a construction worker, or accountant, or engineer, or minister, or ex-military, or whatever. You are a person who has these multiple skills and experiences. If, say, teaching and writing and growing things are your favorite skills, then you can approach either the job market of teaching, or that of writing, or that of gardening. Multiple job markets open up to you, not just one. 2. By doing this homework on yourself, you can describe in detail exactly what you are looking for. This greatly enables your friends, LinkedIn contacts, and family to better help you. You approach them not with, I'm out of work, let me know if you hear of anything, but with a much more exact description of what kind of anything and in what work setting. This greatly helps them to focus down and look for something very specific, thus increasing their helpfulness to you and your ability to find jobs you would otherwise never find. 3. By ending up with a picture of a job that would really excite you, and not just any old job, you will inevitably pour much more time, energy, and determination into your job search. This is really worth looking for, so you will redouble your efforts, your dedication, and your determination when otherwise you might try but soon give up. Persistence is the essence of a successful job hunt, and persistence becomes your middle name once you've identified a prize worth fighting for. 4. By doing this homework, you will no longer have to wait to approach companies until they say they have a vacancy. Once done with this homework, you can choose places that match who you are and then approach them through a contact, or what I like to call a bridge person, because they know both you and them and thus serve as a bridge between you, knowing confidently that you will be an asset there if they turn out to have a job opening or decide to create one for you. Create one for you? No, I'm not kidding. This happens more often than you would ever think to the prepared job hunter or career changer. Wrote one job hunter to me recently. In my mind, I knew where I wanted to work, a company I had had a couple of meetings with about an imperfect job about 2 years ago and fell in love with. I found the CEO on LinkedIn, asked him if he remembered me and would he be up for a short meeting if I promised it would be fun. He said he would love to meet, and I pitched the idea of setting up a training academy for them. About a month later, I had an email to say they definitely want to go ahead with providing training as I had pitched it. The job did not exist, they had not conceived of the job, and it meets all my criteria because I thought of it. From parachute to dream job in 6 months is not bad, is it? 5. When you are facing, let us say, 19 other competitors for the job you want, equally experienced, equally skilled, you will stand out above them all because you can accurately describe to employers exactly what is unique about you and what you bring to the table that the others do not. These will usually turn on adjectives or adverbs, what we normally call traits. More on that in the next chapter. 6. If you are contemplating a career change, maybe, after you inventory yourself, you will see definitely what new career or direction you want for your life. Often you can put together a new career just using what you already know and what you already can do, with much less training or retraining than you thought you would have to do. I'm not talking about a dramatic change, like going from salesperson to doctor. For that, you will need to start over. But most career changes are not that dramatic, as I will show you in Chapter 11. But first, please, please, inventory who you are and what you love to do. It may turn out that the knowledge you need to pick up can be found in a vocational or technical school, or in a 1 or 2 year college. And sometimes, it can be found simply by doing enough informational interviewing. More about this in Chapter 8. Example. A job hunter named Bill had worked for a number of years in retail. Now he was debating a career change, working in the oil industry. But he knew virtually nothing about that industry. However, he went from person to person who worked at companies in that industry, just seeking information about the industry. The more of these informational interviews he conducted, the more he knew. In fact, coming down the home stretch just before he got hired in the place of his dreams, he found he now knew more than the people he was visiting about their competitors and some aspects of the industry. In other words, with certain kinds of career change, there is more than one way to pick up the knowledge you need. 7. Unemployment is an interruption in most of our lives, and interruptions are opportunities to pause, to think, to assess where we really want to go with our lives. Martin Luther King Jr. had something to say about this. "The major problem of life is learning how to handle the costly interruptions, the door that slammed shut, the plan that got sidetracked, the marriage that failed, or that lovely poem that didn't get written because someone knocked on the door." A self-inventory is just that type of thinking and assessing. The parachute approach, with its demand that you do an inventory of who you are and what you love to do before you set out on your search for meaningful work, helps you take advantage of the opportunity that this interruption presents. So, there you have it. The 7 reasons why this inventory of who you are works so much better as a method of job hunting than all other methods. Being out of work or thinking about a new career should speak to your heart. It should say something like this: use this opportunity. Make this not only a hunt for a job, but a hunt for a life, a deeper life, a victorious life, a life you're prouder of. The world currently is filled with workers whose week-long cry is, "When is the weekend going to be here?" And then, "Thank God it's Friday." Their work puts bread on the table, but they are bored out of their minds. They've never taken the time to think out what they uniquely can do and what they uniquely have to offer to the world. The world doesn't need any more bored workers. Dream a little. Dream a lot. One of the saddest pieces of advice in the world is, "Oh, come now, be realistic. The best parts of this world were not fashioned by those who were realistic. They were fashioned by those who dared to look hard at their wishes and then gave them horses to ride." How to do a self-inventory. These are the things you will need. 1. Mental preparation. You begin by stripping yourself, in your mind, of any past job titles. When you ask yourself, "Who am I?" you must drop the vocational answer that first springs to mind, like, "I'm an accountant," or "I'm a truck driver," or "a lawyer," or "a construction worker," or "salesperson," or "designer," or "writer," or "account executive." That kind of an answer locks you into the past. You must think instead, "I am a person. I am a person who has had these experiences. I am a person who is skilled at doing this or that. I am a person who knows a lot about this or that. I am a person who is unusual in this way or that." Yes, this is how a useful self-inventory begins. You are a person, not a job. 2. One sheet of paper, digital or physical. Brain researchers such as Barbara Brown of USC discovered that when you are trying to make any kind of decision about your life, the most effective strategy is to shrink down every significant thing you know about yourself onto one piece of paper, at least at the end. Not a journal or a bunch of post-it notes or several pieces of paper, just one. Write small. In this book, that one piece of paper that you end up with is called the flower exercise or flower diagram. 3. A number of worksheets. As you are working your way towards summarizing everything important about yourself on just one piece of paper, you are going to need along the way a number of disposable blank pieces of paper. I call them worksheets, in order to do a particular exercise, or two, that I will show you for each flower petal. I emphasize disposable. You will ultimately be copying the final results from these worksheets onto your flower diagram, after which you can recycle these worksheets. For these worksheets, you are going to need to get a bunch of 20-pound blank sheets of paper. 4. Some kind of a graphic or picture. Again, brain researchers discovered that it helps immensely in making a decision about your life if you don't just put a flood of words on that one piece of paper, but add some kind of a graphic, picture, or diagram. They discovered that this encouraged the right side of your brain to spring into action, the part of your brain that can look at a whole bunch of apparently unrelated data and exclaim, "Aha, I see what it all means." Some like to call this your intuitive side, the opposite of your logical side. In the workshops that I taught from 1970 to 2012, I encouraged my students to choose any graphic they wished. We needed a picture with 7 parts to it, corresponding to the 7 parts of you that are important in finding matching work. Well, the favorite graphic turned out to be a picture or diagram of yourself as a flower, with a center and 6 other petals. Hence the title of our self-inventory, the flower diagram or flower exercise. 5. A prioritizing instrument or grid. It is easy to imagine that the purpose of a self-inventory is to gather a series of personal lists to which you then try to match possible jobs or careers. For example, here is a list of all the things I want in my place of work. Or, this is a list of all the skills I want to be able to use at my next job or career. But over the past 40 years or so, we have discovered that lists are useless unless and until the items on each list are put into order of priority or importance for you. This item is most important to me. This is next most important, next, then next, etc. And why is this? Well, we live in an imperfect world, and, at least initially, you may not be able to find a match for all the items on your lists. You may only be able to find a match for some of the items. There will be only a partial overlap between dream job and actual job, in which case it is important that the overlap be the items you care the most about, not the least. And how will you know that unless you put the items on each list in order of importance to you? This problem is visually summarized in the PDF files included with this audiobook. Okay, so prioritizing is essential. How do you go about this? Having compiled a list of, say, 10 items on one of the petals in your flower diagram, how do you decide which of the 10 is absolutely the most important to you? Which of the 10 is next most important, etc.? It seems at first sight a bewildering challenge. Actually, it's easier than you think if you compare just 2 items at a time until you've compared all the possible pairs in that list of 10 items. With all the pairs displayed in one diagram, this works out to be a grid. And the most popular form of that grid turns out to be my prioritizing grid, which I invented back in 1976. It can be for any number of items you choose, but the most common and simplest form of it is for 10 items. Got more than 10 or less? See http://www.beverlyryle.com/prioritizing-grid for instructions. Anyway, the PDF file shows what a 10-item grid looks like once it is completed. Take a look at it now. As you can see, this example deals with a 10-item list of people I'd prefer not to have to work with. You will produce this list, or one like it, by means of an exercise you will find in the next chapter, reviewing your past experiences. I'll use this example to illustrate how you use any 10-item grid. I originally had more than 10 items as a result of that exercise, but by guess and by gosh, I narrowed them down to my top 10, and then worked just with them, here. Section A. Here, I put my list of 10 items in any order I choose. So, as you can see, the people I prefer not to have to work with are those who are bossy, never thank anyone, are messy in dress or office space, claim too much, are uncompassionate, never tell the truth, are always late, are totally undependable, feel superior to others, or never have any ideas. The order in which I list these items here in Section A doesn't matter at all. Section B. Here are displayed all the possible pairs among those 10. Each pair is in a little box, or rather, the numbers that represent each pair are in a little box. You ask each box a question. The framing of the question is crucial. The question you address to each box is, between these two items, which is more important to me? Or, since this is a grid of dislikes, which of these two do I dislike more? Think of choosing between two hypothetical jobs. Let's see how this works. We'll start with the first little box at the top. The box has the numbers 1 and 2 in it. Number 1 stands for bossy, while number 2 stands for never thanks anyone. So the question is, which do you dislike more, number 1 or number 2? You circle your preference in that box. I circled number 1 because I dislike being around bossy people at work more than I dislike being around ungrateful people. You go on now to the second box, down diagonally to the southeast, which has in it the second pairing, in this case, the numbers 2 and 3. The question again, which do you dislike more? I circled number 3 in that box because I dislike being around messy people at work more than I dislike being around people who never thank anyone. And so it goes until you have circled one number in each little box in Section B. Section C. Section C has 3 rows to it at the bottom of the grid. The first row is just the 10 numbers from Section A. The second row is how many times each of those numbers just got circled in Section B. As you can see, item number 1 got circled 7 times, item number 2 got circled 1 time, as did item number 10, a tie. So to break the tie, I look up in Section B to find the little box that had both number 2 and number 10 in it, to see which I preferred at that time, and I see it was number 2. So I give number 2 an extra half point here over number 10. Item number 3, I notice, got circled 3 times, but so did item number 4 and item number 7, a 3-way tie. How to break that tie? Well, here you'll just have to do some guessing. I guessed these were important to me in this order. Number 4, number 7, and then number 3. So I added half point to number 4 and 1/4 point to number 7. I left number 3 as it was. In the third and bottommost row of Section C, I put the ranking according to the number of circles in the second row. Item number 6 got the most circles, 9, so it is number 1 in ranking. Item number 8 got the next most circles, 8, so it is number 2 in ranking. And so it goes until that whole bottom line is filled in. Now the only task remaining on this grid is to copy the reorganized list onto Section D. Section D. The aim here is to relist my 10 items from Section A in the exact order of preference or priority for me, using Section C as my guide. Item number 6 got the most circles there, and it ranked number one. So I copy the words for item number six into the number one position in section D. Item number eight ranked second, so I copy the words for item number eight into the second spot in section D, etc., etc. What I am left with now in section D is the 10 items in the exact order of my preference and priority. Nice. I can copy them all now, or at least the first five, onto my flower diagram in the next chapter. I now know what should be in the overlap between my dream job and the job I initially find, if I am to be happy and effective in that job. Where can you find blank copies of this prioritizing grid? Here are the three main places. In this book. If you have a print copy of this book, a 10-item paper version appears throughout the next chapter. If you have the audiobook version, you can find a blank prioritizing grid in the PDF files. I suggest making several copies. Since some copy centers will not allow you to copy items out of a book without permission, tell them you have my permission to copy or reproduce that grid as many times as you wish for your own private use, not for inclusion in an e-book or another published work. In a workbook, its title is What Color Is Your Parachute? Job Hunter's Workbook, $12.99 online, or at bookstores. Another paper version, but its advantage here is that the workbook pages are larger, 8 inches by 10 inches. Online. We are working on an elegant web version of the grid. Can't say how soon it will be done. Meantime, I've given my friend Beverly Ryle permission to produce a simpler online version of my prioritizing grid that is automated and interactive. It is found at www.beverlyryle.com/prioritizing-grid, and it is free. You can use my 10-item grid there, or customize a grid for any number of items you choose. Needless to say, you can use her website as many times as you wish, and print out the results each time for your own keeping. 6. Conclusion. Prioritizing the petals. Before you go on to fill in the petals in the next chapter, it is sometimes helpful to ask yourself, in the abstract, which petals, which parts of a job, do you instinctively feel are most important to you, at least for now, and in what order? A. The salary. B. The geographical location. C. The people you work with. D. The look and feel of your workplace. E. The degree to which it gives you a sense of purpose for your life, or fits in with the purpose you want your life to serve. F. The degree to which it lets you use your favorite skills, abilities, or talents. G. The degree to which this job lands you in your favorite field or fields of knowledge and interest. You can just guess in what order these are important to you, or you can use a 7-item prioritizing grid to get this exactly right. For a paper version, take a 10-item grid, draw a horizontal line in section B just below the 7th item in section A. And don't use any boxes in section B that are below that line. Or if you have access to the web, you can go to Beverly Ryle's website and create a customized interactive 7-item grid found at www.beverlyryle.com/prioritizing-grid. If you want to know which petals other people have most often picked as their first priority in the past, the answer varies. A lot depends on where you are in your life and which issue you are most preoccupied with, such as meaning or mission, effectiveness, survival. If they're just trying to survive, their first choice is usually the salary petal. If they're on in years, it's the purpose petal. If they're anywhere in between, it's the petals dealing with abilities, talents, skills. But all seven petals are important to you. Don't leave any of them out. Flowers are the most lovely thing God has given the world. Christian Dior, 1905 to 1957. Chapter 5, Self-Inventory, Part 2. The Flower Exercise. This self-inventory is a flower with seven petals, including the center. That's because there are seven sides to you, or seven ways of thinking about yourself, or seven ways of describing who you are, using the language of the workplace. People, working conditions, knowledges, geography, salary, transferable skills, purpose in life. This flower diagram can be found in the PDF files included with this audiobook. If you prefer a different metaphor, you are like a diamond with seven facets to you as we hold you up to the light. 1. You and people. You can describe who you are in terms of the kinds of people you most prefer to work with or help. Age span, problems, handicaps, geographical location, etc. 2. You and a workplace. Or you can describe who you are in terms of your favorite workplace or working conditions. Indoors or outdoors. Small company or large company. Windows or no windows, etc. Because they enable you to work at your top form and greatest effectiveness. 3. You and skills. Or you can describe who you are in terms of what you can do and what your favorite functional or transferable skills are. For these are key to your being in top form and at your greatest effectiveness. 4. You and your purpose in life. Or you can describe who you are in terms of your goals or sense of mission and purpose for your life. Alternatively, or in addition, you can get even more particular and describe the goals or mission you want the organization to have where you decide to work. 5. You and the knowledges you already have. Or you can describe who you are in terms of what you already know and what your favorite knowledges or interests are among all that stuff stored away in your head. 6. You and salary or responsibility. Or you can describe who you are in terms of your preferred salary and level of responsibility, working by yourself or as a member of a team, or supervising others, or running the show, that you feel most fitted for by experience, temperament, and appetite. 7. You and geography. Or you can describe who you are in terms of your preferred surroundings, here or abroad, warm or cold, north or south, east or west, mountains or coast, urban or suburban, rural or rustic, where you'd be happiest to do your best work and would most love to live all year long, or part of the year, or vacation time, or sabbatical, either now, 5 years from now, or at retirement. I am a person who is all these things. You could choose just one, two, or three of these sides of yourself. Let us say, what you know, or what you can do, or your preferred salary, as your guide to defining what kind of work you are looking for. But what the flower diagram does is describe who you are in all seven ways summarized on one page in one graphic. After all, you are not just one of these things, you are all of these things. The flower diagram is a complete picture of you, all of you, in the language of the workplace. And believe me, you want the complete picture. I'll tell you why. Let's say there is some job out there that matches just one petal, one side to yourself, one way of defining who you are. For example, Let's say this job lets you use your favorite knowledges that you already have, but that's it. That job doesn't let you use your favorite skills, nor does it have you working with the kinds of people you most want to, nor does it give you the surroundings where you can do your best work. What would you call such a job? At the very least, boring. You would barely be able to wait for, "Thank God it's Friday." Some of us have already sung that song a lot. But now, let us suppose you could instead find another kind of work that matches all seven sides of you, all seven petals. What would you call that work? Well, that's your dream job. So, your complete flower diagram is a picture of who you most fully are. And, at the same time, it is a picture of a job that would most completely match and fulfill all that you are. Where you would shine, because it uses the best of you. Make it your goal to completely fill in your flower, and try to feel it as a joy rather than a duty. Determine from the beginning that this is going to be fun, because it sure can be, and should be. Readers have asked for a list of all the places or forms where they can find this flower. Here are the three main forms. In this chapter, of course, a paper version, free if you own the print version, and in the PDF files of the audiobook. In a workbook. As I mentioned earlier, its title is What Color Is Your Parachute? Job Hunter's Workbook. And its advantage here is that the workbook pages are larger, 8 inches by 10 inches. Online. In response to many requests, we finally produced an online video course a few years ago, walking you through this flower exercise step by step, with me as your guide throughout. Requirements: a computer and a printer and paper to print out the worksheets. It is available at a discounted price for readers of this book. The unique URL for ordering it is www.eparachute.com/PARA19. It can be used by individual readers or by a whole workshop. The course was put together by the principals at eParachute, myself as content and on-screen host, Marcy Bowles as executive producer, Gary Bowles as producer, and Eric Barnett as technical consultant on Udemy's platform. And since you asked, there are other online resources on topics related to this flower exercise and this book. Dozens of videos may be found at www.youtube.com/results?query=Richard+Bowles. And a bunch of articles can be found at www.jobhuntersbible.com. One word of caution. Don't spend a lot of time on these side roads. Stay focused on your one main task, completing your flower in whatever form you choose. You can go roaming later. Now, let's begin with the seven petals. Here is the first. I am a person who has these favorite kinds of people. First petal. My preferred kinds of people to work beside or serve. Goal in filling out this petal: to avoid past bad experiences with people at work, since who or whom you work with can either make the job delightful or ruin your day, your week, your year. What you are looking for. 1. A better picture in your mind of what kind of people surrounding you at work will enable you to operate at your highest and most effective level. 2. A better picture in your mind of what kind of people you would most like to serve or help, defined by age, problems, geography, and so forth. Form of the entries on your petal. They can be adjectives describing different kinds of people: kind, patient, or they can be types of people, as in the Holland Code or Myers-Briggs typologies. Example of a good pedal. Holland Code, IAS. 1. Kind, generous, understanding, fun, smart. 2. The unemployed, people struggling with their faith, worldwide, all ages. Example of a bad pedal. People in trouble, young, smart, in urban settings. Why bad? Not much help. Too vague. Pedal 1, Worksheet Number 1. A hexagon, the party game exercise. Every job or career has a people environment that is characteristic of that career. Tell us what career or job interests you, and we can tell you, in general terms, what kind of people you would prefer to work with, from among 6 possibilities. Or start at the other end. Tell us what kinds of people you prefer to work with, in terms of those same 6 factors, and we can tell you what careers will give you that. It was Dr. John L. Holland who came up with this theory, and with a system for applying the theory to yourself. Surveying the whole workplace, he said there are basically 6 people environments that jobs can give you. Let's tick them off. The quotes are John's definitions. 1. The realistic people environment, filled with people who prefer activities involving the explicit, ordered, or systematic manipulation of objects, tools, machines, and animals. Realistic, incidentally, refers to Plato's conception of the real as that which one can apprehend through the senses. Knock on wood. I summarize this as R equals people who like nature or plants or animals or athletics or tools and machinery or being outdoors. 2. The investigative, people environment, filled with people who prefer using their brain, specifically the observation and symbolic, systematic, creative investigation of physical, biological, or cultural phenomena. I summarize this as I equals people who are very curious and like to investigate or analyze things or people or data. 3. The artistic people environment, filled with people who prefer activities involving ambiguous, free, unsystematized activities and competencies to create art forms or products. I summarize this as A equals people who are very creative, artistic, imaginative, and innovative, and don't like time clocks. Incidentally, there's a fascinating book about those whose primary code is A. It's called The Career Guide for Creative and Unconventional People, 4th edition, by Carol Eichelberry with Carrie Pinsky. 4. The social people environment, filled with people who prefer activities involving the manipulation of others to inform, train, develop, cure, or enlighten. I summarize this as S equals people who are bent on trying to help, teach, or serve people. 5. The enterprising people environment, filled with people who prefer activities involving the manipulation of others to attain organizational or self-interest goals. I summarize this as E equals people who like to start up projects or organizations or sell things or influence or persuade or lead people. 6. The conventional people environment, filled with people who prefer activities involving the explicit, ordered, systematic manipulation of data, such as keeping records, filing materials, reproducing materials, organizing written and numerical data according to a prescribed plan, operating business and data processing machines. Conventional, incidentally, refers to the values that people in this environment usually hold, representing the historic mainstream of our culture. I summarize this as C equals people who like detailed work and like to complete tasks or projects. According to John's theory, Every one of us could become skilled in all six if we were given enough time. Instead, in the limited time we have from childhood to adulthood, we tend to develop preferences and survival skills in just three of these people environments.